My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest. Welcome back to the Coffin Fellows podcast. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited for this conversation today with Lisa Feria, a Coffin Fellow from Class 22. Lisa, how are you?
I am doing great. How are you, Jeff?
So good. It's so good to have you here. First, let me brag about you a little bit. So Lisa Feria is the CEO and general partner of Stray Dog Capital, a venture capital firm that invests in early stage food, food tech, and biotech companies that deliver financial rewards and have a positive impact on people, animals, and the planet. With over 45 investments, Stray Dog Capital is one of the leading early stage investors in the plant-based market. Lisa, previous to Stray Dog, Lisa spent over 15 years focused on food operations and consumer packaged goods. She led the marketing, P&L management, and strategy for billion-dollar brands and multinational companies such as Procter & Gamble and General Mills. She has an MBA from the University of Chicago and a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from the Georgia Institute of Technology. And she's also been selected twice for the top 100 Latina leaders in the United States list by the Hispanic Executive magazine. Lisa was the benevolent dictator of her class in Class 22 and also was selected by her peers in her class to receive the Jeff Timmons Award for her class, which recognizes those that best exemplify the traits of a Coffin Fellow. Lisa, so many accomplishments here, so many things to talk about, but thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm excited to chat with you.
All right, so tell us a little bit more about Stray Dog Capital first.
So Stray Dog Capital is an early stage venture capital fund, and we are focused, really big picture, on changing and leveling up the food system. We invest in early stage companies in food, food technology, synthetic biology, and cellular agriculture. And we focus on entrepreneurs who really are bringing game-changing solutions to the food world.
Now, and you started with a degree in chemical engineering and then an MBA. What is the path to chemical engineering, MBA, to now food and ag tech?
Yeah, my path to engineering was probably very overly simple. I really liked science. I always have liked math, and I was very analytical. And so I wanted to be in a place where I could figure out how things worked, but I didn't want to be, for example, in the oil industry or something like that. I wanted to really understand the food system. I've always been fascinated by food. But after working a few years in operations and engineering, I realized that I wanted to learn more about the strategy and how do you set strategy and how do you put together a company and a brand and grow it. When you're in the operations engineering side, you end up executing a lot. And I really wanted to be on the team that kind of put together the strategy that other people executed. And so I went to University of Chicago to really learn more about finance and brand management and consumer insights, et cetera. So I can really fully understand the full deck of how do you grow, manage, and how do brands thrive.
And you're really one of the leading and most active investors in this space. So it's great to be able to pick your brain and to listen to the perspectives that you've built over a lifetime. I want to go to where this started for you. So let's, in order to fully appreciate your full journey and your, you know, kind of story arc, let's really start at the beginning. So tell us about your upbringing. Like, tell us about your parents, your mom, your dad, how you were raised. What were some of the important things for you as an early child?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in San Juan, Puerto Rico. My dad is actually Cuban. And so my family left Cuba when Fidel Castro came into power, and they had to leave with absolutely nothing. I mean, just the clothes on their back. And my father went through the journey of starting out in a strange place, which now that I have kids, I can't even imagine, you know, picking up my stuff and not even my stuff because you're not allowed to take anything, getting on a ship and going to another place to try to make it work. And so my father always had this and really passed this on to me, a very entrepreneurial, very hardworking, very resilient personality, and my mother as well. My mother and my father actually got married when they were 17 because they had me. And so I was able to experience firsthand both of their struggles as they put food on the table, as they worked, as they developed a career, etc. And so I grew up seeing two people really, really hustling, really working very hard every day to accomplish not only their dreams, but their dreams or aspirations for me.
If you had to describe your mother and your father in one word, I know this is a really tough ask. How would you describe them?
Resilient.
For both?
For both of them. Absolutely resilient. I mean, my mom never went to college. I remember when she had me at, you know, 17, her work was to spray people in the department store with perfume. You know, the ladies or the gentlemen that are like, do you want to try this perfume? And then spritz it. It's like, that was her job. That's how she put food on the table. But she was so strong. Every cent that came out of there went into our family and into helping me with my education, into helping expose me to different experiences and classes. And if I were to say two people that I admire the most in the world would definitely be my mom and dad.
When I see a lot of that strength and resilience in you with what I know of you, Lisa, tell me about your childhood. What was your childhood like? What were some of the formative experiences that you had that maybe led you to some inflection points? And we're going to talk about inflection points. That's really important for us at Coffin Fellows and on this podcast. But let's start with, what was your childhood like moving to this new country with your parents that were so strong and resilient? And what were some of the formative experiences that you had?
Yeah, my life growing up in Puerto Rico was a great combination of things. So my parents were working really hard, but I was also surrounded by a lot of family and a lot of uncles and aunts and cousins. And, you know, very much surrounded by community. And at the same time, you know, I've always loved animals. For example, my grandmother, she lived in a rural area. That's where she grew up and lived. And I remember going with her there on the weekends, visiting her, and she had a horse, and I would literally read, because I've always been an avid reader, from the back of the horse. Like, the horse would not move. I was just reading on top of the horse. I just had all these experiences, very benevolent interaction with animals. And being in an island, you live a very outdoorsy life because you're in the ocean all the time, you're surrounded by different animals. And so that was very formative for me because I've always seen that interaction as, and generalized that up until a point, until an inflection point, I generalized that interaction. Like, that was the interaction that we should and have with animals in general. And later to find out that absolutely was wrong about that. But grew up, you know, working really hard, studying really hard, and having, like many, many other people, having a little bit of the expectations and hopes and dreams of my family on my shoulders, where I was the oldest grandkid and the firstborn, you know, of my mother's generation, of her five siblings. And a lot of expectations and hopes that I would go to college, that I would, you know, do better and accomplish more. And I felt the support of my family, my community to do that in my life.
Did that ever become heavy for you or too heavy for you? But, you know, kind of this weight that you talk about, or was it the support of your family that really lifted you up through kind of meeting and exceeding those expectations?
Oh yeah, it is a weight that I don't carry lightly, pun intended, because you can never fully fulfill it, I guess, and then you get into this in between spot. You know, part of my way to get these opportunities was to come to the United States. It was to go to school here. It was to follow career choices here. But that comes with a price. That same community and family and environment, I had to leave that in order to achieve what they wanted for me. So it's always this conundrum of, in order for me to really pay out all the attention and work that my family did on my behalf, I had to leave in order to do that somewhere else and really maximize that potential. And so that responsibility of really doing something with all these hours and all these things that my family gave me in terms of support is something that I carry with me every single day. And I think that responsibility also led me to make very safe choices in the beginning of my career, to try not to rock the boat, to try to follow a very safe and mainstream path and very safe and mainstream companies and really big companies and follow that well-trod path, because I could not fail, or I did not want to fail and fail my family. And that has changed over time, how I see that challenge, but that responsibility, I still carry that today. You know, whenever I go back and see my family, and, you know, if I take them anywhere, I always tell them that they already paid for that. Like I'm treating them because they already paid for that by by investing their time and love and support on me. So that bill has been paid a long time ago. And all I have is the rest of my life to continue to try to provide and shower them with any blessing that I have, because they already had done the same for me when I was growing up.
I love your self-awareness around that, Lisa. And it's real that having that support and that community around you, as you're making these big decisions, it really does. The first kind of decisions that we make when we're out on our own tend to be much more risk averse and much more safe, which I know today for you is a different journey. You've grown beyond that to be able to accept more risk. And we're going to talk about that a little bit, but let's make sure, I want to stick with this for just a moment. So you talked about coming to the U.S. and you came to the U.S. to go to college. That must have been a really big decision for you. In fact, maybe one of the first inflection points of your life. Tell us a little bit about that. Like, how did you choose where to go to school? What was that decision like? Give us a little bit of sense of that.
Yeah. So I started my university career in the University of Puerto Rico. And the friends that I developed in during that very short time, I still have today a very strong group of friends. But at some point in that path, I realized that in order to maximize my career opportunities and just opportunities in general, I wanted to come to the United States. I wanted to learn English better. And I wanted to really follow the path of opportunity. And so I came over to finish my chemical engineering degree in Georgia Tech. And it was quite a shocking experience for me. Definitely an inflection point for me, because I went from a very small island. Puerto Rico is 100 miles by 35 miles. It's tiny. From being surrounded by generations of friends and family. And because even if you moved away from your family in Puerto Rico, the furthest you could go is 3 hours away. So it's really not that far. So, you know, you have a lot of family near you. You know, our holiday get-togethers are 300 people. That's just the closest family members. And so I went from that to knowing absolutely nobody, to having learned all my chemical engineering terms in Spanish, and then having to learn them in English, and not in my freshman year, from having a culture that I was just part of many, right? It just never stuck out, into really sticking out, into, you know, just so many, the climate, everything was just a shock to my system. And I had at some point, I was facing the two paths here, to go back, because it was really rough in the beginning to really receive so many changes and differences and feel so basically alone and lonely, or to, you know, buckle down and make it work. And that inflection point has been, now that I look back in my life, so significant, because after I decided that I was going to make it work and I was going to thrive, and dang it, I was going to, you know, do my family proud and make it, that generated this whole new backpack of tools, if you will, that yes. I've been pulling from my entire life. It really is true that adversity breeds transformation, because I went from a person, you know, a specific person with choices and thoughts, to, you know, now the whole, I was able to look at so many other opportunities that I would never have considered because I realized that I was resilient too. That not only did my family pass on, you know, hair color or eye color, but they also passed this trait of resilience and of perseverance. And so I was able to really, you know, buckle down and focus on learning all these new things very quickly. I mean, when I started, I've always done well academically, but when I started at Georgia Tech, I started getting C's, and I was, you know, this is a shock to my system. I've always done well academically. And I realized that in order for me to be able to continue to do well, to get better grades, I had to build, you know, study groups and help build those relationships to get into those groups that were already established. So this interloper would come in and try to charm some groups into letting them join them. I would have to learn all these terms in English and do it incredibly fast. I would have to figure out a way to maintain my mental health while, you know, being in a place that wasn't my own. And I was going to, you know, do what it took to make it work. And so that whole experience for me was so important. And to walk out of there and graduate and making it into the Chemical Engineering Honor Society, like just being able to make it was such an important point for me to draw from at so many other times in my life. When I look at a very big challenge, like I'm fundraising now, and I look at the amount that we're fundraising, and you know, it makes me sit back and makes me wonder, can I do this? Right? There's not many other Latinas out there that have raised this amount of capital. And then I think back at when I've been faced with similar, you know, moments of tension and difficulty, and that I was able to make it. I do have the skills necessary to figure it out. It's a pond that I constantly drink from, that inflection point. It was a big deal for me.
Such a transformative experience. And as you're going through this transformative experience, this big inflection point in your life where you're really learning to flex these resilience muscles that you have been given by your family and learned through your parents and continue to flex when you got here to the States, you're also developing your thesis. You're also kind of understanding some of the things that you knew that you loved as a child. You're starting to have that come into more clear formation. And that happened, I think, with maybe one of your first jobs or one of your first internships. Tell us a little bit about how that started to come together.
Yeah. So as I was in college and I started facing this dichotomy that will define, you know, the rest of my life up to this point, between, you know, staying in the middle, fitting in, not sticking out in any way, shape or form, following the safe path, doing what others have done, and really trailblazing. And so my first internship was actually the former. I got a job at a consulting company for the Navy, and it was a job that, from a skill set standpoint, I could absolutely do. And I thought, great, you know, this pays well. It's a great opportunity. It's great for my resume, et cetera. And I remember showing up for my first day, and my boss sat me down, and this first question out of his mouth was, "So Lisa, you know, welcome to blah, blah, blah company. And I just want to, I want to start this conversation by asking you one question. Okay. What is it? What is your favorite type of warfare?" That was the question that he asked me. What was my favorite type of warfare? And I was flummoxed, to say the least, because I don't know if you have a favorite type of warfare, Jeff, but I don't have a favorite type of warfare.
Lover, not a fighter here.
Oh my gosh. It really was a preview of my summer where, you know, square peg, round hole, I could do the job. It was a terrible job for me. And it doesn't matter how center of the path of the road it was. It doesn't matter what the paycheck was. It was not a good job for me. And there's only so much that you can make a square peg in a round hole work, right? At some point you will get distorted. Your essence will get distorted. You will change, and not in a good way, not in a natural way.
Yeah.
And I realized after that summer that there were some, every job has a price to pay. You're paying a price for it. And it could come in many different variety of ways. But the price that I had to pay for that job was basically giving up and changing completely who I was just to stay in a safe job and a safe path. And it was not worth it. It wasn't worth it.
Wow. What an important learning for you. So then, and then you mentioned yours, the second job that you had. How was that different than this?
Yeah. So my job that I had, well, this is a P&G, my Procter & Gamble career. And I, you know, was a P&G, and I love P&G because it's such a learning company. You learn a ton while you're there. They actually call it the learning company. And they are very process oriented about teaching you how finance works, how R&D works, how all those things work together. And so I spent a lot of time enjoying being part of such a big company and all the perks associated with, again, being in the center of the road. But then I had another inflection point where I was doing some research, and I went to PETA's website, and I saw this video called Meet Your Meat. And it was one of those moments where I'm telling you the story, I still remember how I felt. And I remember where I was sitting. And I remember that I felt like the room started swaying, and because I couldn't believe that animal agriculture was that way. It just, you know, to me, again, I grew up in this very, I don't know, naive, I guess, idyllic interaction with animals when I was growing up. And all of, you know, like the farmers were family farmers. And that's the way I thought it was. I honestly, as idiotic as it sounds to me now, at that point, I thought, hey, animals have a great life and a bad day, right? And because it doesn't make any sense for a family farmer to be abusing his animals or her animals because, you know, that's their profitability. So in my very analytical mind, I was like, okay, A plus B equals C. They want profit. They want these animals to all make it, right? So they're treating them, you know, well. And the reality is the complete opposite. They have an absolutely, absolutely horrendous life and a good day. And that was one of those moments where I realized, well, you know, when I landed, I was like, there's no way this is true. This must be the one location or the one place. But the more that I realize, the more doors that I open, the more windows that I look through, is that, yes, this is the way. This is the way that that we are right now. This is the way animal agriculture works. And I realized that the more information that I gathered, the more alarmed that I grew. Because I think this is very typical of somebody in their 20s or 30s, you know, bad things were a long time ago, whether it be, you know, oh, you know, social justice issues and desegregation, all that. That was a long time ago, right? Or, you know, the world, all the icebergs melting and the world becoming, you know, going in a path of no return, all that. That's a long time from now. Like, none of those things are going to touch me or, you know, have been remotely touching me or my generation. And the truth is that this is my generation. This is your generation. All these things are happening in our lifetime. Because of the way that we feed ourselves, we are on a path of no return as it comes to climate degradation, water usage, antibiotic resistance. You know, animal agriculture is to blame for over 80% of Amazon deforestation. You know, I found that out. I was shocked because I thought those two things weren't connected. They are. Over 70% of antibiotics today are used on animals. So talk about antibiotic resistance issues. 30% of all climate changing emissions come from animal agriculture. I mean, it's just overall is such an ugly picture. And I realized that, you know, I'm sitting there in my comfortable spot at P&G. I could continue to sell paper towels and toilet paper and, you know, all these Gillette things, or I could really do something about it. I could really put my time and treasure and talents towards something that really is going to matter for me, for you, for my kids, for, you know, their kids' kids. And that was my second inflection point. I had these two paths: continue to be safe or start the trailblazing. Start, you know, go through the brambly path, because there, in my mind, there was no other choice. You know, I really had to step off this place where I felt that I could have a career forever into a place that was completely unknown and new. because I, you know, I believed and still very strongly believe that it was the right thing to do.
You know, I love this juxtaposition between wanting to fit in and feeling like you have this need and desire to fit in because you come from community, and that was a big part of your early childhood, to then transitioning to really also wanting to and feeling like you need to be a trailblazer. You had this quote that you've pretty much already talked through, but I love this quote. I want to read it. So I had the realization I needed to change my trajectory. I wanted my life to be about something bigger and to drive something more meaningful and solve the largest problem in humanity, which is the fact that the food system is unsustainable. And that's clearly what's driving you today. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely.
So tell us about now what you do, like what gets you excited? What gets you jumping out of the bed? You've transitioned to clearly being a trailblazer now, and all the things that you're working on with investing in food and ag tech and biotech companies. What gets you jumping out of bed every single morning that says, I am the most blessed person in the world to be doing what I do?
Yeah, I think it's because I finally stop trying to be a square peg in a round hole. I finally stop being okay with being in roles that I could do well, I could succeed at, but that didn't really fulfill my desire to do something meaningful and something that mattered. I didn't want to die and know that I sold everybody one more roll of Bounty paper towels. I wanted to die and have the realization that, you know, I was a small piece in a big system that really helped us change our path. I mean, the universe just gave us a timeout. That's what the pandemic was. We just got a massive timeout for the whole world to really think about our choices. And so for me, that's what gets me up every day, is to say, okay, I don't want to hand over a world on fire to the next generation. I don't want to be one of those generations that, you know, the Generation C or millennials are looking at us like, hey, are you asleep? Like, you guys destroyed the planet and, you know, you're not doing anything about it. Now this is what we're inherited. I don't want to be part of that. I want to be part of the solution. And so that when Straight Out Capital came together and we started investing in alternative proteins, it, you know, we had a really hard time finding investors that would invest in us. And it was because food was not sexy. Who wants to invest in General Mills? I mean, no offense intended, but it's not sexy, right? It might be a consistent company, but it's not sexy. And everybody was so enthralled and interested in other categories. Well, the food that we invest in is a completely different world. What we're trying to build is a completely different world. We're not trying to build a slightly better food system. We're really trying to upgrade and level up the entire food system. And so once we started funding these amazing companies, including Beyond Meat, for example, and people and investors started to see what kind of impact that could have on people's health, on choices, on the environment, on animal welfare, all those things, and financially, because we are doing really well as a fund from a performance standpoint, then all of these things are starting to come together. We're starting to, you know, talk to and educate a lot of institutionals on the food world, the food system. And so what gets me up every day is being able to get more informed, educate, and get more people to develop an awareness about what's going on, to continue to partner with everybody to improve how we eat for our own health and for the health of the planet, and to add additional capital into the space so we can really make the size of change that we want to accomplish.
This mission is so important and just so inspiring. What do you say to those that would say that the transition to more plant-based nutrients and the Beyond Meat examples and others like it are inherently even less healthy because of the materials that are put in there, synthetic or whatever, versus the actual meat itself? I don't believe that to be true, but you're the expert. Tell us what you say to those people.
Yeah, you know, I when I talk about this with anybody, the first response I typically get is, well, I cannot, you know, two things usually. I cannot stop eating cheese is the first one pretty consistently. It's either cheese or bacon.
That's pretty tough.
Yeah, right. And the second one is, well, you know, an Impossible Foods has a lot of ingredients in there that are unpronounceable, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Here's what I say about both of those things. You know, my job and the job of our fund is to find companies that replace those amazing, delicious, you know, sensual, sensorial, incredible products that we all love to have with plant-based and better alternatives, right? That don't destroy your health, because you shouldn't be having bacon 17 times a day. But our objective is to continue to back companies that will provide plant-based bacon that you can have 17 times a day. You know, I think Beyond Meat and that wave of companies were the first wave, and their objective was to mimic meat as closely as possible. Their second, third, and fourth wave of companies, the ones that I'm looking at today, are able to deliver the same nutritional or the same sensorial impact, but also not have an ingredient label that scares anybody, actually delivering on the nutritional piece and on the environmental benefit as well. And you look, even a Beyond Meat or Impossible Food Burger is, you know, significantly better, like 90% better in terms of energy usage and water consumption, animal welfare, all this stuff. So even that one, it's still so much better for the environment. And from a health standpoint, we are continuously supporting companies that will bring us all a better world. Because Jeff, don't you want to be able to eat your most delicious, you know, food, but without being concerned that's going to give you a heart attack in 10 years or diabetes or high blood pressure?
Amen, you know, sister.
Yeah,
yes.
Who doesn't want that? Everybody wants that.
Absolutely. So well said. Just another amen to you. Thank you. So Lisa, at Coffinfellows, we talk a lot about the idea of your zone of genius and also how that maps to an investment thesis. Let me just first ask you, as we focus this episode on investment thesis, which you clearly have such a well-defined one, what does zone of genius mean to you? And how have you gone about developing your zone of genius?
Yeah, so my zone of genius, so the zone of genius in general is this kind of combination of, you know, how you grew up and the characteristics passed on to you by your family or the way that you grew up, and what did that bring to your life? The talents and treasures that you have yourself, the things that you're naturally good at that you do really well that others have a harder time doing or being able to deliver like you do. And how do you connect those things and ideally connect them to what you do every day and your work?
So what would you say is your zone of genius?
Yeah. So my zone of genius, I am a weird combination of right and left side brain. So I am very analytical, very nerdy. I mean, this is why I went to Georgia Tech and University of Chicago. I love data. I love analytics, numbers, math. So I'm very, very right, but I'm also creative. I'm also very relational. So I have an interesting combination of both sides that I'm able to look at very complex things, but also be able to look at life and see possibilities and see the gray, not only the black and white. I've always been very environmentally aware and conscious and with a love of animals, right? So that in general, anything that connects those two things has been, you know, a place that I have a natural attraction for. And I have always wanted to, you know, support kind of the underdog. That has been something that in general has been a consistent in my life. You know, one of my models forever and ever is pull up as you go up, because right now, I hate saying this because it's so, the number is so low, but I'm one of eight Latina women with funds over 50 million in the United States. One of eight. Nothing like that you should be able to count with your hands. Like that is a dismal, sad number. And so for me, you know, anything that connects the analytical plus the creative, anything that connects environment and animals, as well as this whole space of being able to leave a better world than I found, that whole area is my zone of genius. And that is exactly what the mission of Straight Out Capital is.
And I guarantee you, Lisa, for that number to grow from one of eight to one of 800, it is because people like you are doing exactly what you said. You're trailblazing. You are laying the path. You're inspiring others to see that this is possible, that we need more people just like you with your passions in particular spaces like food and ag tech to be doing what they're doing. How would you say that your zone of genius, I mean, there's a lot of ways to look at zone of genius. One is exactly the way you described it. It's your where you're in flow, the things that come easy to you, the things that come naturally to you, the things that you do so well that you're like, gosh, everybody does these well, right? Like this isn't anything special. But then there's also this area of your zone of genius where it's kind of, you know, it's similar to the 10,000 hour rule that Malcolm Gladwell has popularized, you know, that you put enough time into something that it becomes very right. much something that you are very, very good at, and it maps to your passions. How have you taken those two pieces of the zone of genius and mapped it to your investment thesis with what you're doing today?
Yeah. So for me, I always knew that I had these interests, these traits passed on to me by my experiences and my family and my upbringing, as well as these natural tendencies, my zone of genius, what I can do well. And then the two pieces that came in with dedicating time enough to make that a zone of genius, that was venture capital. And that was the specifically investing in venture capital food companies. Those were the things that I knew how to manage analytical information, and I knew how to talk to people and build relationships. What I did not know when I moved over from Procter & Gamble to venture capital is how to do venture capital. And so that became my 10,000 hour area that now I would like to say that it's my zone of genius as well, which is venture capital expertise and venture capital expertise in food investments. Because food is actually a very complicated space to invest in. It's not a widget that you can turn on from 0 to 20 million. Food is, you know, an actual physical product that you need to get to from A to B to C to. And the food system in the United States is very complex and involves distributors and brokers and retailers. And it just has a lot of different steps in there. And so to identify and figure out what were the right food companies to invest in, that was the 10,000, another 10,000 hour, you know, dedicated, eternal student. And I'm still learning today. I can never say that I think that I arrived, I know everything that there is to know. You know, one of my traits is that I'm very thirsty for knowledge, and I have a thirst for knowledge and a thirst for learning and always improving myself.
That's such an important point that in regards to your zone of genius and your investment thesis is the idea of a growth mindset, like Carol Dweck talks about, where you are, while you still may be an expert in an area, you may have a zone of genius in an area and you're focusing your thesis on it, you are a voracious learner. You're constantly wanting to learn and to grow and to bring in new knowledge. Because again, as you said, it's a very complex industry that you're investing in, and it's changing. Well, it's probably not changing as fast as we'd like it to, but it's changing. And we need to make sure that we are continually learning so we can be a part of that, accelerating and catalyzing that change. That's really important. Lisa, if we were able to jump in a time capsule and go back and visit the college dorm room of the young Lisa Feria that had just kind of come over to the U.S. and was going to university and was still in the mindset of wanting to fit in, and now you're able to, as the trailblazing Lisa, talk to that younger Lisa Feria, is there anything that you would say to that younger version of yourself?
Yeah, you know, now I think back on, you know, not only this consulting Navy role that I did for the Navy role, but I think about other roles that I've done in my life and how I try to make the square peg fit. I try to make it fit in the round hole so hard, and in so many ways just kind of put up with a lot of unhappiness and ill-fitting roles and ill-fitting responsibilities, because I was so afraid of what would happen if I jumped and tried something audacious. If I jumped and tried something that got me out of bed every morning excited, that didn't feel like such a chore or such a burden. I wish that I could, you know, look at myself and tell myself to not be so afraid of steering and stepping off the safe path, that's actually where happiness is to be found and satisfaction.
So you are a Kauffman Fellow from Class 22, as we mentioned before. Tell us about how Kauffman Fellows falls in your journey or in your narrative, and how has it shaped you?
Oh my goodness. So Kauffman Fellows has been instrumental and incredibly important in my journey. And so that my first interaction with a Kauffman Fellow, actually a local fellow, I got a reference to him from an entrepreneur that is also a Kauffman Fellow. And he's a local fellow, so I had coffee with him. And I remember thinking, oh, this is going to be a hard sell to join Kauffman, right? And I already did a lot of school. I don't want to do any more school. And I remember sitting through that to that coffee appointment with him and just being amazed at the person he was. Just like a, such a cool, you know, open, vulnerable, but interesting, but intriguing, but smart, charismatic. And just, I remember meeting him and saying, well, if this is where, if Kaufman Fellows is where people like this are to be found, I want to know more of them. You know, I think this could be a place that could really help me in my next role in my venture capital journey and could help me with learning more about venture capital, kind of going back to the 10,000 hour quote. And I remember the more people that I met in Kaufman, and also when I was in the class, just being amazed at being around people that manifest their own destinies and how important and influential that was for me. You know, people were really taking a hard look about their journey, where they were in their journey and where they wanted to be in their journey. And I saw so many courageous leaps and jumps to that, you know, from here to there, from gigantic established companies into starting out different venture capital funds. And just, I just saw all these leaps and all these moves and people, you know, different fellows hiring other fellows and being exposed to the speakers and their view of what we were doing and what they were doing. It was just so inspirational. You know, up until then, I thought, okay, I'm an engineer, you know, in training. Venture capital is relatively new to me. I am never going to be able to raise, you know, double digit million, let alone triple digit million dollar funds. That's not something that's in my path. I can't do that. And after being around other fellows, I thought, you know what? I think I can do it. Like, I think this is in my path. And I feel like if it wasn't for Kaufman Fellows, I wouldn't have jumped. And that, it just set me in a different path. It set me in a path of no, like, why do you close the door before, why do you close the door on yourself, right? Before you even had a chance to peek through it. Like, you didn't even give yourself a chance to step through the threshold and see what the air was on the other side. And to really have the guts to have the support system to step through the threshold and always knowing that I have a brain trust to lean back on with all the fellows, and I do quite frequently, that I have a vested group of people that wanted each other to succeed and had always enough time to provide to each other, always a hand to pull you out and lead you. I mean, it's just amazing. I'm still today, I was texting people in my class about different things. They're asking me things. I'm asking things. In our group chat, people are asking about, you know, whatever's going on. We're celebrating each other's successes. It's a wonderful community, you know, kind of going back to where I started. Being around this community is so helpful and it feeds the soul. So it helps the career and feeds the soul. It does both things.
Well, Kaufman Fellows is better because you're in it and you're an inspiration to many, Lisa. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, the only thing I would add is if you haven't tried plant-based eating, I would highly, highly, highly encourage it. It doesn't have to be every day or every meal or all the time. But from a health standpoint, from an environmental standpoint, it's a win-win kind of situation. So I would invite you to try it and always reach out to me if you have any questions. I have a million recipe books and ideas about movies and things you could watch if you want to learn more about it.
Lisa Feria, dropping knowledge for us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kaufman Fellows.